The Guardian.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. On this week's podcast, believe it or not, there are many, many unanswered questions about our universe.
Once we discover it, and once we understand it, it's actually the route to every science fiction idea that you can imagine. Time travel, warp speed, anti-gravity devices, tractor beams.
It even brings into question some of the foundations of science.
We're having all these trouble unifying it and finding a quantum theory of gravity, perhaps because gravity is not really a fundamental force. Perhaps it's something else, there's something deeper that we still don't understand.
It's summer, so we're visiting a festival. There's giant colour-reading eyes, and we listen in on a session with a sex scientist.
You will learn things. I learned things last year. I was amazed at how naive I was. I was like, what am I doing wrong? I can't believe I don't know this.
Plus, is the moon getting smaller? And zombie ants.
He referred to them as mass graves of these ants clinging to the undersides of leaves. That the ants are complete shells by this point.
This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Welcome back, everyone. In the studio today, we've got astronomy writer Stuart Clark. Not shy for a challenge, his new book is simply called The Universe, and it tackles 20 of the most interesting and vexing questions about, well, the universe. Are we made from stardust? Are there other intelligent beings? Is there cosmological evidence for God? We'll come to some of that stuff a bit later, but first, Stuart, why don't you go through something a bit fundamental, which is that we don't know what most of the universe is actually made of.
What drives astronomy is the observation of movement, really. And as we look at movement throughout the universe, so we see that there is more gravity there than seems to be capable of being generated by the amount of atoms in the universe. So that leads you on to believe that there must be extra matter out there. And it can't be normal atoms, we don't think, otherwise we would have found that by now. And so perhaps it's other particles of nature, particles that were extremely important when the laws of physics were being forged and in the very early times of the universe. But they play very little part in interactions today, except to generate this extra gravity. That's what we call the dark matter, and that's what everybody is clearly trying to find. Now, if dark matter doesn't exist, if we simply can't find it, it means that our understanding of gravity is wrong, and we have to go back to the drawing board and do more fundamental physics.
And of course, as well as dark matter, there's dark energy.
And dark energy, again, is to do with different kinds of movement, this time not movement of galaxies in the universe, but the expansion of the universe as a whole. And that's taken us by surprise because it seems to be accelerating. And the only way that we can imagine at the moment that you can accelerate the expansion of the universe is to have some weirdo substance called dark energy.
And dark matter is one of these things which seems almost a bit familiar. You can imagine if there's some stuff, there's some particle that we just can't detect. That's almost understandable. And there are many, many candidates for what these things might be. And there are many ways of trying to find them on Earth through various detectors. Dark energy, though, I mean, is there any concept of what this stuff is? Is it a fluid? Is it particles? Is it just some mysterious fifth force?
Yeah, it's really tough to understand. It could be any and almost all of those. So it could be an energy associated just with the vacuum of space. If that's the case, then once we discover it and once we understand it, it's actually the route to every science fiction idea that you can imagine. Time travel, warp speed, anti-gravity devices, tractor beams. We will be able to use dark energy to do all of those amazing things.
We have to find it first, obviously.
But you have to find it. Yeah, it has to exist.
It has to exist.
First of all. If it's a force, if it's another fundamental force, that should mean that you would imagine that it's a quantum force, and so there will be new particles associated with it there. Or perhaps, again, it's just a misunderstanding of gravity, and we haven't quite got gravity right on the very largest scales.
So let's go into things that perhaps that we do know about the universe. I always imagine that because the universe is something like 13.7 billion years old, that might be the size that so related to the size of the universe. So, you know, the expansion of the universe happens at the speed of light. You imagine the edge of the universe is 13.7 billion light years from where I am now. That's not quite right, is it?
That's not quite right. Because just to confuse the issue completely, it's taken 13.7 billion years for the light from the edge, if you like, of the universe to arrive at Earth. And of course, in those 13.7 billion years, the universe has continued to expand. So right here, right now, if we were to say how big is the observable universe, well, you have to go back and rely on the equations of general relativity to see how much larger it's expanded in those 13.7 billion years.
Do we know how big it is?
And it's about sort of about 90 billion years light years across.
90 billion light years, okay. And so, but there's a limit to how far we can ever see. We can only ever see 13.7 billion years. And beyond that, it's impossible to ever...
You can only ever see up to the cosmic microwave background radiation, which is the furthest light that you will ever see in the universe. Because before that point in history, the universe was just filled with all these broken up pieces of atoms and particles that were just like a huge cosmic fog. So light couldn't propagate in long straight lines through that. So you will never see beyond this fog with light. You might do it with particles. You might do it with neutrinos. And if we ever have a quantum theory of gravity, you'll be able to do it with gravitons. But that's kind of centuries in the future, I think.
This is about as doable as dark energy and other things. How do we know that the same laws of physics apply in 13.7 billion light years away as they do here?
You would imagine that if the laws of physics were capable of changing, that when you looked a long way back into space, that it would just be completely nonsensical to you. That doesn't seem to be the case. We seem to clearly recognise stars, we clearly recognise galaxies. And so that seems to suggest that the laws of physics don't change in a wholesale way throughout cosmic history. But what there might be happening is that the constants of nature, the things that are like the gearing ratios between two different quantities, maybe they change very slightly over time.
In the same universe?
In the same universe, that's right. So as we look, and there are some observations that I do discuss in the book that suggest that if you look extremely far away, well, perhaps the electrons surrounding the atoms are in slightly different positions because something called the fine structure constant has changed by a minuscule amount.
Because that has huge implications to have the fine structure constant or any of these other sort of, there's about six, aren't there, constants of the universe which have to be put in by hand into the physics equations. If any of them are slightly different, you get a very different universe. You get stars collapse quicker than normal, and that means that life can't evolve on planets around them.
It's one of the big unknowns in all of our physics and astronomy, why the constants of nature have the values that they do. And as we try to unify all the forces with string theories and new particle physics, so we think that perhaps these constants are conserved, but over huge multi-dimensions. So we get into the realm of multiverses and other universes nearby ours. And as the multiverse evolves, so the constants of nature can change in any individual universe, but are conserved over the multiverse.
Are you saying that it can be completely random in different universes? These things are just random figures, and it happens to be that our universe, or our version of the multiverse rather, happens to have these constants, which allow you then to do the things that, you know, that we see around us.
That's the way that people are thinking at the moment, that if there is this infinite number of other universes, this multiverse, then it's no surprise that we live in a universe where the constants of nature are just right for us.
Will this stuff ever be testable? The idea of a multiverse, the idea that string theory exists in 15 dimensions, 11 dimensions. I mean, we are getting into philosophical realms where science doesn't really have a test for this stuff, does it?
The difficulty always is with these highly complicated mathematical theories is to try to get something that you can test and you can measure. And there are certain ideas about gravity and other particles that we may be able to test in this way. And my wish is that those are the things that we concentrate on. I'd like to see many more fundamental physics experiments in space. We've never really done the equivalent of Galileo just rolling balls down slopes in space, for example. We've never dropped things in space and timed them to see if there's any real difference between...
Is this where the International Space Station might be able to help?
Yeah, we could just have astronauts up there
dropping balls. Dropping. Yeah. That'll go down well. What's in store in the next decade or so in terms of the big experiments that are going to test some of these things?
We've moved away from the kinds of spacecraft that can actually detect the gravitational force really, really easily. The old-fashioned pioneers and things like that do show apparently anomalous movements that we still haven't quite explained. They may be just problems with the spacecraft and the tracking. But there's also the flyby anomalies that we see today as well, that sometimes spacecraft seem to pick up a little more energy than you expect them to when they fly by planets. There are spacecraft that will help test these kinds of things. One of them is the European mission LISA Pathfinder, and that's going down this route of just having a free-floating object, a test mass within the spacecraft itself, just to see what forces act on it. What are the completely natural forces that move this? And can we explain those in the same way that we do the lunar laser ranging at the moment? And we see, can we explain the movement of the moon just with general relativity?
LISA is also going to be looking for gravity waves.
That's right. The full-on LISA mission is a number of decades hence.
Can you explain gravity waves in less than 10 minutes?
In the same way that that an accelerated electrical charge will give out light, and light is just a wave motion, an accelerated gravitational mass will give out gravitational energy in the form of a wave that ripples through this thing, the space-time continuum, this fabric that's everywhere.
And we haven't detected them yet, but we know they must exist.
They are the last great prediction of general relativity that we have yet to experimentally verify.
Richard Feynman once said that if people want to know one thing about science, he said the most important thing to know is that everything's made of atoms and that things flow from that. That's the most important single fact. And in this book about the universe, which contains everything, what's your one thing that people should know about the universe?
Gravity is the architect of everything. So without gravity sculpts the universe on the largest scales. It brings things together. It brings matter together so that all the other forces can work. But gravity is the architect of the universe. And that's what we should be putting all our efforts into making sure we understand.
And we still don't really understand the edges of gravity.
It's really tough. I mean, I'm starting to think that perhaps even...
And it's not even a real force anyway. It's just a sort of bending of space-time.
Yeah,
it's
I'm starting really to think that we're having all these trouble unifying it and finding a quantum theory of gravity, perhaps because gravity is not really a fundamental force. Perhaps it's something else, there's something deeper that we still don't understand.
You heard it here first. Gravity is not really a fundamental force. I can't finish this without asking you about things like black holes and time travel.
If we can understand black holes, we can understand the origin of the universe, because the same mathematics that goes into these black holes is the same as the mathematics that sort of talks about the Big Bang. And again, we need to get inside the black hole, and to do that, we need a quantum theory of gravity. So,
which may not exist.
Yeah. And that puts everything in a really interest that would throw everything into real confusion. The whole point about general relativity was that you include time in the same breath as space, and that time is an extra different, just a slightly different facet of space, and that means that we could be able to time travel. And there's nothing in general relativity that says that you can't, but what you need is vast forms of energy to sort of open up these wormholes and things like that and allow you to do that. And for that, the kind of energy you need is dark energy.
Stuart's book, The Universe, is out now. If you follow this podcast on Twitter, look for Science Weekly. We'll let you know every time a new podcast is launched. And for the rest of the Guardian Science content, you can just follow Guardian Science.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk with Alok Jar.
Have you ever wanted to teach a giant synesthetic brain to sing? Or take a boat trip to discuss intimate places with a sex scientist? No, neither have I. But we've gone and done it, so you don't have to. They're just some of the bizarre things you can do at the Secret Garden Party, a festival held every year in Cambridgeshire. They're organised by Guerrilla Science, a group which promotes science by turning up in unexpected places, such as music festivals. We sent Heather Christie along to A, find out more about synesthesia, which is a neurologically based condition where one sense involuntarily triggers a second sense. For example, numbers or letters can be perceived as colours. And B, we asked her to find out more about, well, sex.
Okay, you're going to love this, Brain. You are going to love this.
So I'm here staring at a giant foamy brain with various gears and flowers and paraphernalia shoved into it. The brain is hooked up to a giant eyeball that is staring at all sorts of colored objects. And there are little children running around everywhere trying to get more colored objects, because when you put a different colored object in front of the brain, it makes wild and crazy noises. Yeah. It's part of a project that the folks of Coney have put together for the Guerrilla Science tent here at the Secret Garden Party. So let's chat with them and see what this is all about.
And that goes down. That means it is still confused by the colour.
Well, people do, when they have synesthesia, they do hear sounds. Well, they can hear sounds. It's one of many different types of synesthesia, but they'll hear sounds when they see either colours or shapes or even letters. It's quite a common form of synesthesia.
Good. Does that all make sense, yeah? Yeah, makes sense. So,
I'm Tom Wright, and I'm from the University of Sussex, and I learn synesthesia.
Yeah, the sound goes up.
When you translate an image into a sound, it can be translated back into an image in the brain of someone who's lost their vision.
So you're saying that this same technology could be used to help blind people see what they hear, or hear what they see, or what they would see?
Exactly, yes. And we've got a lot of evidence that shows that they're genuinely seeing something, it feels like they're seeing it, and you can show that they're using areas of the brain which we commonly associate with vision as well.
Yeah! Yeah, it's brilliant, yeah.
You can take a man or a lady, depending which you identify with, and you'll be working on that about what you like touched on your own body.
I'm Petra Boynton, and I am a social psychologist who works in international health at UCL, and my specialty is sex and relationships research.
You will learn things. I learned things last year. I was amazed at how naive I was. I was like, what am I doing wrong? I can't believe I don't know this.
I basically got people to take line drawings of a male or female body, depending on which they are identified with, and to stick on to the body stickers, red for where they didn't want to be touched at all, yellow for which they didn't mind, and green for which they really, really enjoyed being touched. So one person might hate having their feet touched, but somebody else really loves it. And also to get them to see that although genitals are important in sexual pleasure, that actually there's a whole other area that we often miss. Women who've had babies will often not put anything on tummy, or say they don't want to be touched on the tummy. And it's not because it hurts or it's painful, it's because it doesn't look the same and they feel very self-conscious about it. So actually, although it could be pleasurable, they've now wiped that off their enjoyment list.
Question one. What decade was this guide for using the vibrator written?
1891. I'm shouting. It can become a bit competitive. I found doing it with young men is that they all insist that every area of their body they like. But as again we saw in this activity today, there's still areas of the body that are taboo, so a lot of men won't admit that they enjoy anal stimulation at all. And in some cases it's because they don't, but sometimes there is that peer pressure that nobody wants to say in front of group, I actually quite like this. Although I was glad to see quite a lot of men were saying, well, I haven't done it, but I'm open to trying.
When is the right time to ask if they have a condom on them? Before they get into the house, that's very presumptuous of you. My God, do you even buy them a drink first?
Sometimes it's that they've been led to believe that there are areas they should like. So, for example, breasts, that, you know, our culture very much values breasts. So most women will say they like them being touched, and most men or most lesbian women will say that they like touching breasts.
Surely that might get in the way of some of your fun. I mean, you're just getting going with it, and then...
In terms of what's happening in the field of sex research, it's very diverse. We're seeing much more interesting work about looking at sexuality. So lesbian and gay, bisexual, a real push towards bi-identity and seeing bisexuality as an important area as distinct from lesbian or gay or straight. But the thing that I think interests me the most is work that people are now looking at around pleasure and around the body and around enjoyment, and particularly around what makes good relationships. I think we've realised that we've done an awful lot of good work on our problems and how to solve them, but we haven't done half as much about what's nice and being in loving relationships and how they work and what they look like.
The idea with this is that you would carry it around with you and rub it a bit, and it would hopefully make you more fertile or make you be able to have a baby.
often assumptions that everybody is straight. There's not really any discussion around variety. So, you know, if a woman says she's not experiencing orgasm, it will be things like buy a sex toy and new underwear rather than looking at her relationship as a whole.
Okay, we'll move off that. Apparently, they actually did work. They did work. Slightly uncomfortable, did work. Any other forms of really rubbish contraception we can think about?
I'm always asked, you know, what's the future of sex? And it's usually with people having the idea that we'll all be having sex with robots, you know, in the next 5 to 10 years, or that we'll all be having sex with sex dolls, or, you know, there's all sort of predictions that come up. If you look at sexual behaviour, I think what's very interesting across history is it doesn't tend to go in just one forward movement. You have points in history where we were a lot more liberal, points in history where we were a lot more conservative. It's affected by politics and economics and all sorts of other factors going on. So I think in the next 5 to 10 years, 15 years, I don't think we're actually going to see great huge changes, as in we'll all be, you know, plugged into the internet by our brains having sex with somebody on the other side of the world. You know, we could probably email them, but I don't think we'll be, you know, I think the sense of a great huge mechanical embodied shift is going to happen.
Best ever it is, yeah, it's what you decide you wanted to be. It's that if I told you now it's pumpkin season, you believe me and you went and had them, it would work.
Yay! Heather Christie there in Cambridgeshire. More details at guerrillascience.co.uk. You can join our Facebook group, search for the Guardian Science Weekly podcast, where you can chat with other listeners and post comments on the wall. We'll also let you know whenever a new podcast is uploaded every Monday.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk.
Let's take a look now at some of the other science stories around this week. Our panel consists of science correspondent Ian Sample and the prodigal child returns, James Randerson. How are you?
Oh, I'm very well, thank you. It's lovely to be back.
You're stepping down from management class to come down and do some science once again.
It's been too long.
Well, let's start with Ian. Apparently, ants are quite... Well, they're zombies.
There are certain species of ants which unfortunately get infected by... Unfortunately for them, get infected by a fungus which controls their behaviour. And the story I was interested in this week was that scientists have found the oldest evidence of this kind of behaviour at 48 million years ago by looking at the distinctive markings that you could call it a possessed or a zombie ant leaves on a leaf once it has been killed by this fungus. And I'll tell you a bit about what happens is your ant is crawling along the forest floor and it picks up some fungal spores which start growing into the ant. As they grow in, the fungus starts releasing this chemical, the alkaloid chemicals, which start affecting its behavior. Most of the time, these ants live around in the tree canopy, the forest canopy, and it makes them stagger about and they fall down and they land on lower leaves where it's more humid and the temperature's just right for the fungus to start growing really quickly. The fungus then basically takes over the ant. In its final hours, the fungus actually causes the ant to go towards the underside and the main vein on the leaf and latch its mandibles into that leaf and lock itself there where it dies and it becomes a little home for the fungus.
How does the fungus itself spread?
Well, what's quite revolting actually is that...
None of this has so far been revolting.
No, when this ant is locked in place, and you can find what the scientist told me were, he referred to them as mass graves of these ants on the clinging to the undersides of leaves, that the ants are complete shells by this point. The fungus actually grows... basically a stem out of its head, which forms a pod full of spores. And at nighttime, that pod fires spores out onto the forest floor, where they land and basically lie in wait for other ants to come by. And it's a fascinating sort of evolutionary adaptation. I mean, we don't know sort of where it came from, but or indeed how this fungus controls the ants, what the chemicals involved are. But it's the oldest evidence they've found yet.
How common is this kind of mind control in the natural world, and why is it significant that it's so old?
Well, it's pretty rare. Parasites are incredibly common, but there aren't that many really that go this almost extra mile and start seriously influencing the behavior of the host. There are some which are quite prominent, like toxoplasmosis, which is a parasite that cats spread, which can affect the behavior of mice and such like, and affect the behavior of humans as well. It can make humans more risk-taking and can make mice fearless of cats, which is very advantageous for the cat.
Well, for the toxoplasmosis that wants to get back into the cat.
Exactly, and let's not pretend any of this is is done knowingly. This is just the way evolution has panned out, and this kind of thing happens. But James, you're asking about why this sort of matters, why it's interesting to find such old evidence, 48 million year old evidence of this kind of mind control of ants going on by this parasitic fungus. The scientists, and they're based at Harvard, are really interested in working out what the evolutionary pressures were on the fungus that caused it not just to infect the ants, use them as host and then eventually kill them, but to actually cause this spectacular behavior in them, because it's going a lot further than a lot of parasites would. And 48 million years is the oldest evidence they've found so far, and it, that doesn't mean it started then. It may have presumably started way, way earlier than that, but it gives them kind of a start to look at what kinds of things were going on in the environment that may have led the fungus to adapt in this kind of way.
All right, we'll stay in the natural world. James?
Well, what I've got for you is the story of the Pavlovsk seed bank, which is on the outskirts of St. Petersburg.
Is this as gruesome as ants?
It gets that way, but
bear with you.
Stay with me. It's a seed bank of over 5,000 varieties of plants, including strawberries, blackcurrants, apples, cherries, etc. And 90% of what they've got there occurs in no other collection. But at the moment, there is a plan to destroy the seed bank to build a housing estate, and in a bizarre sort of form of logic, the property developers are saying because it's impossible to put a price on this collection, it's essentially worthless. You can't put a value on it, therefore we can't value it, which is kind of bizarre. And things are not looking good for this particular collection.
James, you have these seed banks which store all of these different varieties of plants and such like, but what actually is the point of them?
Well, yeah, there are a few dotted around. Kew has a very good one, for example. And the idea is that you're able to preserve genetic diversity of all sorts of varieties of plants that are useful to us. So in future, if some kind of new disease came along, new crop disease arrived, you might be able to dip back into that genetic diversity from the past that we no longer use and find varieties that would fend off a particular kind of disease. So it's really important to maintain that diversity in research collections.
Also, the interesting sort of scientific point about these seed banks is that they don't really know how long a seed will survive. So you kind of have to keep growing them every few years. You pick up a few from the bank and grow it out. I mean, the Millennium Seed Bank at Kew, they're doing this. They've got tens of thousands of seeds there. Some plants which are already extinct, so they could possibly repopulate in hundreds of years if others go extinct.
And that's why you can't just move this seed bank really easily, because a lot of the plants are planted out in fields.
Yeah. This particular seed bank that you're talking about has a bit of a tragic history.
It does. It's a fascinating story. During the 900-day siege of then Leningrad, 12 scientists were trying to guard the collection, and they opted to starve to death rather than eat their own plants in the collection. So, you know, that's a tiny little corner of human suffering in that whole episode. But it just shows the sort of dedication that the scientists have had.
And then what's happening now? Is it going to be closed?
Well, there is a point of light in this story, in that after the Guardian wrote about it a couple of weeks ago, and perhaps partly because of the publicity we've given it, there was a bit of a campaign on Twitter, and if you search for #Pavlovsk, you can see some of those discussions. And as a result of that, the Russian president, Dmitry Medvedev, tweeted that he wanted to look into the issue. So maybe there'll be some kind of review.
This is amazing. This is the Guardian.
The
changes
power
the
of
world.
Twitter.
Exactly. I want to talk about sponges now. This is a story that came out in Nature Geoscience last week about the fossil of what looks like an ancient sponge-like creature that probably lived in the ocean reefs off Australia, which some scientists think pushes back the direct evidence of first animal life on Earth by almost 100 million years. Now, before this, the oldest animals, if you like, that we have fossils of are about 550 million years old, and the oldest sponge itself is 520. But this thing, this new fossil, is dated to almost 650 million years old, which is interesting because it's just before a massive, massive glaciation event called the Marinoan glaciation, which is where the entire planet was covered in ice. And people thought before now that there's no way, if animals had somehow evolved, even simple animals, that they could have survived this massive trauma, because there was nowhere for them to have lived and survived.
What do these things actually look like, and how have they managed to image them and sort of demonstrate what they look like?
The way they've imaged it was really interesting, because when you have a fossil this ancient, it's very hard to tell the difference between the actual living material, the dead material, and the rock that it's encased in. In fact, they're made of the same substance, calcite. So, in fact, what they did was, you can't use x-rays to tell the difference between these different things. So what they did was quite interesting. They took the piece of rock in which this fossil was, sliced it up really fine, 50 micron thin slices, and took 500 of these. Each one, they took a high-res picture, put it all into a computer, and essentially built a 3D model using these high-res images. And that's where they got this idea that it's, you know, it has these tubes and it looks a bit like a sponge. It's an interesting way of imaging.
Are there actually holes in the rock? I mean, do the inside of the tubes, the lumen, are they made of different mineral, or are they holes?
I guess they can't be, because otherwise you'd be able to tell from the places where there are gaps. But it's interesting in that it does push back this idea of when animals first came along. All right, well, one more story. Apparently, if the zombie ants and the fact that animals are older than we thought aren't enough of a sign of the apocalypse, surely the moon shrinking is. Is it shrinking?
It is. Well, it certainly has been recently. It may still be shrinking. And by recently, I mean geologically, in geological terms.
So before your time even.
Exactly, before even I was around. This was from some research out of the Smithsonian Institute with some other scientists from NASA and such like, where they've studied some of the most high-res images of the moon ever taken from the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, one of the NASA's NASA probes. And they've looked through thousands of these images and found these wrinkles on the moon's surface. And the wrinkles essentially are a sign of the moon shrinking. And what they've done is they've looked at these wrinkles that they found. They've only looked at a tiny amount of the moon's surface, and they found 14 of these wrinkles and worked out that they correspond to a shrinking of the moon's diameter of about 200 meters. Obviously, the moon is enormous, and that's a tiny percentage, but it's a shrinkage nonetheless.
Why is it shrinking? What could the physical process be?
Well, when the moon formed, and the best guess is that it happened when something the size of Mars crashed into Earth about 4.5 billion years ago, produced an enormous debris cloud, which then condenses to form kind of the fledgling moon. And inside that, as these particles are crushed together in those compressive forces, you get friction between the particles that produces heat. You also have radiation from some of those particles, which produces heat. So you end up with a warm core and a warm body, which is the early moon. And over time, it will cool down. Now, some people think that the moon is cold, hard, and dead, and has been for very long. But this suggests that quite recently, maybe even ongoing, that the moon is actually still cooling. As it heats up, you know, in its early life, it expands a bit, and then it gradually cools. And you can see these kinds of, I mean, I call them wrinkles. They're technically called lobate scarps. Essentially, what happens is, as the moon shrinks, it's exactly what happens on a prune. The surface compresses, and so you get ridges coming up. And these ones on the moon are about tens of meters high. If you go to somewhere like Mercury, where the cooling has been much more extreme, these wrinkles run for thousands of kilometers and are kilometers high. I mean, they're enormous sort of mountain ranges.
I assume there's no other potential explanation. I mean, obviously, there's no plate tectonics going on the moon, so it's nothing like that.
Well, the interesting thing is that it's not nailed down yet. I mean, what you do want to look at is to see if you find these everywhere, evenly distributed. And the initial signs are good. In the Apollo era, some of those missions photographed similar types of geological formations. But they were all of those missions around the equator, so you didn't really know if these were a common thing on the moon. These ones, this time they found them nearer the poles. If you find them all over the moon, you can be pretty sure that these things are produced by contraction. It's very hard to think, actually, how they would be produced by anything other than that, because they are so distinctive. It's hard to think how else they might be produced. But I'm sure other people will have theories that may be plausible.
Okay, well, to find out more about that and all the other science stories, go to guardian.co.uk/science or environmentguardian.co.uk.
Science Weekly.
That's it for this week's pod. Many thanks to Stuart Clark. You can check him out at stuartclark.com. Thanks also to The Guardian's Ian Sample and James Randerson.
Next week, find out why we go behind the scaffolding at an old railway warehouse in Manchester. Don't forget to add your voice to our debate at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly, where you can also subscribe to this podcast so that every single show gets automatically delivered to your MP3 player. This podcast was produced by Andy Duckworth, with thanks to Heather Christie. I'm Alok Jha. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.